Hello, my name is Dan Mulhern, and I'm so happy to talk to you about the ideas in this CD, Be the Parent Your Children Want to Follow. Let me start with just a couple of ideas at the outset, and then a kind of how to use this CD. The first thing I want to say is that being a parent is the most important place that any of us will ever lead. It's true on a societal level. If you think about it, the job that we do at home will dictate what kind of children enter our school systems. It will determine what kind of citizens vote or hopefully even run for office. What we do at home and how well we lead will determine what kind of workers and managers are out there. So not only is it important to you, I assume that's why you're listening, but it's extremely important for the culture and civilization that we're building. Now the second point, why leadership? Well, here's why. What I found in my leadership reading and writing, and especially in my practice at home, is that if we take the ideas of leadership theory and leadership research and apply them at home, they have us think and, of course, act in whole new ways. They bring a freshness to what we're doing at home and a new angle on how to deal with our kids, or sometimes, I don't know about yours, but you'll hear about mine, pretty challenging from time to time. Ideas that you'll hear in this CD about vision or about communication or about great listening skills and win-win situations are more true at home than anywhere else. I hope you find that's the case. Okay, now two thoughts about how to use this CD. First of all, I would recommend that you listen to it but open up the document that's also on here. It's called Exercises and Ideas. There are some things that are exercises that you might want to do that are helpful, and there's room to just take notes. It's a Microsoft Word document, so you can open it up and expand it if you want to add more, or change things or move things around, or even if you would like to print things out. Here's my second suggestion on how to use this well. Listen to it once. Either sitting down at one time or perhaps, as most of us listen to things these days, in snippets when you're in the car. Each segment is about 3 to 7 minutes or so, no longer than that. But after you've listened to it yourself, and as you listen to it, think about listening to it with your kids, especially if they're 8 or 10 or 12 or 16 years old. I think you might find it very valuable as a conversation starter for you to talk about how you relate to each other, what they need from you as a leader, and it will also serve as a very interesting introduction to them to think about becoming leaders themselves and perhaps create a greater receptivity on their part. Well, that's it. Enjoy it, and I hope it helps you to lead with your best self. The first and continuing practice of great leaders and great parent leaders is to clarify success. It's been said, if you don't know where you're going, you'll get where you get. This is not the motto that steers great leaders. Great leaders are always thinking about and talking about where the team or organization or country is going. What does success look like? What's the destination? What are they aiming for? Where are they going and what makes them different than others? And they keep focusing on that goal, on that picture or vision of success. So it is with great parent leaders. They also develop and repeatedly share a clear picture of success. Nothing is more obvious, is it, than the fact that your children will grow. Unlike many organizations that hope to exist for long periods of time, decades, or centuries, we know that if we do our job well, our children will fly the nest, will be off on their own in a matter of sometimes very short years, certainly as we get to have teenagers. So perhaps more than any other business or organization, because we know that our children are to move on, we should, as we work in the present, be focused on the future. Yet parent leaders don't often stop to really think about, let alone, what I would suggest to you, sit down and write out with the handy guide that's included with this CD, what it is that your picture of success is What's the future you're shooting for? Where are you trying to arrive at? Let me direct your thoughts in three areas to be practical about what I mean by success as a parent, a picture of success. First, I'll ask you to think about your values as a key point. Second, I'll ask you to think about your picture of a totally successful family. And lastly, I'll invite you to envision or to picture what success is with respect to your individual child or children. In this section, I want to suggest to you a way to clarify your values so that you can speak them clearly and effectively with your children. But first, let me talk about why it's important. If you would, think back 100 years ago to, say, the turn of the century, the early 1900s, and think about who else besides you, if you were a parent then, would be trying to influence your children. Where else would they be getting ideas about how the world works and what's important? Well, there would be school, and neighbors, and family, of course, perhaps church. Maybe there's a newspaper in the area. Maybe there's a town meeting or some kind of gathering. Maybe there's a girls' club or a boys' club that meets. Now, fast forward to the current time and think about all of the influences on your children. TV, videos, internet, as they get older, text messaging and internet message, instant messaging each other, and on the phone with their cell phones, and they're hearing from rock and roll figures and rap figures whose values are starkly different than theirs, and they're watching athletes whose behavior may not be the kind you like, and they're watching the Fight Channel, and they're watching movies, and they're playing video games. Do you see the tremendous influence that others have on your children? So how important is it then that you be clear about what you think success is? Because Madison Avenue and Hollywood and Broadway and rap stars, they're going to have their impact on your children. They're going to tell your children what they think is important. So what I would suggest to you, and you can begin with the first exercise in the workbook that's attached to this, is ask, what are my core values? What do I really stand for? What do I think a great life is made of? Is it honesty or love or faith or determination? Is it hard work? Is it loyalty and working with other people? Is it being a person of your word? Is it creativity or innovation? Is it the value of the arts in life? Is it economic independence and being successful? Is it freedom and being able to decide what you want to do? What really matters to you? What do you think your children should know are the kinds of things that if they hold on to them will make them successful people in whatever way you think success is? How clear are you about those values? If you had to write them down, could you say what your top three are? And then you might ask yourself, how often do I speak about these with my 3- and 4-year-olds, with my 8- and 9-year-olds, with my 12-year-olds, or in those difficult teen years? Do my children know what I think is important? Do they know why I make the decisions I make? And do they see my values in action? Because if we have clear values, we have an orienting principle for all of the difficulties that come with life, whether they are the small child, small problems, or big kid, big problems. How clear are you about your values, and how often do you enunciate them? Talking about them as values and telling the stories that makes those values come alive. Talking about values is an adult way to look at a picture of success and what you want your family to be like. In this section, what I'd like to do is share with you an idea of how to actually engage your family in a conversation about what success is like. We know from the leadership field that when our followers are bought in, when they believe in the picture of success, when they've been asked to, quote, share the vision, then we know we have a huge leg up. Then we know we have people not simply complying with us, not simply obeying, but actually committed, because they see that there's some importance and some value in the direction that we are going in. So what I'd suggest is that we can apply the same principle here. In the same way that a good company will not just have the executive team decide on the vision for the company, but will involve all of their employees, all of their shareholders, in asking, what do we want to be like? How do we want to be known? Well, we can do the same thing with family. So what I'd suggest to you is a number of questions that you might kick around. Again, you'll find these in the workbook, but let me share them with you. Imagine yourself in the car. You could have a 5-year-old, again, an 8-year-old, 10-year-old, 12-year-old, or even one of those ornery teenagers. And you could ask some questions that would help you to get at, what is our picture of success? If you want to be daring, you might have a flip chart somewhere hidden around a corner and might even want to bring that out at the end, or might want to take some notes and follow up with your kids to share with them how important you thought the conversation is. But here are the questions that you might offer. You could say to your kids, who seems like the coolest family around? You know, what do you like about the way they are? How are they different from other families? And what seems like it would be really great to be a part of that family? Or here's another line of inquiry to get you to the same kind of place. You could ask your family, your husband or wife and your kids, what do you wish you could answer if your friends or people at church or people down the street asked, hey, what's your family like? What would you love for the answer to be? What would you love to say? Well, our family is like this. Or a third way of getting at it would be to ask them, if you were in the grocery store and you heard someone talking about our family, what would you wish you would hear them say? What would you love? What would you long to have them say? Oh, I saw that family the other day at church, or I saw that family at the park, or, you know, when you see them at the movie theater, what really strikes you about that family? What do you wish they'd say about us? Here's another way to get at it. Ask them, who's your favorite TV family? When you think of all the families you've seen in TV, from the Disney families, from the Incredibles, to Mulan, to other kinds of movies, to the Cosbys, to whoever you've, the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, who's your favorite TV family? And then you might have a conversation. What do you like about them as a family? What is it that makes them special? Still another way to get at this would be to ask, how would you describe our family when we're really at our best? When things are going great for us, what is it that you love about us? What do you really like? What do you feel proud of and enthused about? Finally, you might ask, if you yourself, my lovely daughter, my wonderful son, were a parent with a child or children, and you felt like you had a great family, things were going totally great, how would you describe what it was like to be in your family? These are all conversations that you can have simply as casual conversations. If you want to, as I said, you can take the next step and ask, so how could we be a little bit more like that? What are the words you'd use to describe the way you want us to be? And what are some steps we might take to get there? These are all just ways to develop a picture of a great family so that you could use it as a tool to lead effectively. The third exercise in this series on picturing success, on seeing where you want things to go as a great parent leader, is all about envisioning or seeing a picture of your child or your children as adults and imagining, what is it that I want them to be like? Now, I have to tell you that this runs counter to so much of what we do as parents, so much of what Jennifer and I have done as parents, so much of what our parents did with us. For so often what we do as parents is we see our children as they are. We see them as children. And so often we need to move them along as children. We need to get food in them. We need to get them bathed. We need to get them clothed. We need to get their homework done. We need to get them to school. We need to get them to have a chance to play on the varsity or go to Harvard. We push and push and push. And oftentimes what is driving us is control, so that they do what we want, a clean room, a good plate, a respectful manner. But in the end, what most of us want are not obedient people, not adults who will do whatever their boss tells them to do, or whatever someone more powerful instructs them to do. But instead, I think that we're looking for independent and growing and strong and confident and loving and contributing people. Now, if we think about this from the very beginning, that with a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 7-year-old, yes, I need to get certain behaviors out of them. But in the end, my picture of success is what? Well, it probably has to do with them choosing. So for instance, you may have a teenager who's really struggling in school, and they may be working very hard and be under tremendous pressure, and they may be driving themselves all the time and not feeling good about themselves, and perhaps beginning to act out as well, perhaps beginning to stay out late at night or even experiment with drugs or alcohol. And you realize, wow, a lot of what's driving them is this pressure to satisfy someone, to please someone. But my picture of success is not that they get a 3.5 or a 4.0, not that they're the quarterback on the team, not that they have a million friends, but my picture is that they're happy and independent and well-adjusted. And so I may have to change my behavior, dramatically, to make clear to them what my picture of success is. It isn't that they're the most popular, the thinnest, the smartest, getting into the best school, but it may be something very different than that. They may think that my picture of success is a clean room and an obedient child. Well, maybe. But maybe I have bigger pictures, more positive and important pictures, and I have forgotten to share those. So what I would suggest you here is to think about very clearly what you see as a happy adult, as a successful adult, as an adult that you're proud of and that you think is living a good life. So the last exercise on the first page of your workbook asks you to jot that down. What is your picture of success? What does your child look like when everything is going great? And then you can start to ask yourself in the very moment, in the immediacy of time, in a minor crisis or a major issue, what is my picture of success that should guide me? Where do I want my child to be as an adult? So I've talked about this wonderful picture that you might have of great success, of what your child looks like when they become an adult at 20 or 25, and they've really taken on all of that life offers them, and they've flowered in many ways, physically and emotionally and spiritually, and you're so enthused about them. And now I would suggest that this picture can be enormously helpful in the most difficult of times. Maybe you have a little one, a 3-year-old, and they're having one of those 3-year-old moments. They're having one of those tantrums. And at that time, your picture, the long-term picture, may give you a sense of calm, a sense of detachment, a knowledge that, yeah, you too were crazy as a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old, and you will get through this moment. Or maybe when they're 6 or 7 and they do something wrong, something troubling, they steal something, they lie to you, you say to yourself, okay, what's the big picture? Where do I want to be? What does success look like? And that will control the way you adapt to your children and how you speak to them and what you expect. And then think about this. Imagine a really hard situation. Imagine that one of your children has really acted out. They've done something at school that's brought you into the principal's office, or worse, they brought you to the police station, or worse, they brought you to the doctor's office with something very troubling, and you say to yourself, goodness, I have to have a conversation. Now, if you're a normal human parent, like your parents were, and like perhaps you are, if you just go in to have that meeting, If you come home from work and say, daughter, son, I need to speak with you. Well, what can you predict will be the, not the picture of success, but the picture that will probably ensue after a difficult conversation like this? I don't know. In my house, growing up with 7 kids, there were adolescent girls and adolescent boys who stormed out of the room, who slammed a door, who said, I can't wait to get out of here, who said, I hate this place, who said, even sometimes, worst of all, I hate you. And worse, not only were bad feelings expressed, but sometimes the issue wasn't really resolved. We hadn't moved forward. Well, that's how it can happen. But imagine now using the picture of success in the moment where the rubber meets the road. And so you say to yourself, I'm going to meet with Johnny. I'm going to meet with Letitia. Now, what do I want the end of this meeting to look like? What do I want to hear? What do I want to see? How do I want to think or feel? And you might say to yourself, for instance, well, my picture of success at the end of this meeting is that this child will know that if they do something like they just did, they will not be playing hockey or they will not have the car keys. That's my picture of success. That's simple. They know. They act. There will be consequences. And if I get that done, the meeting will be successful. Or perhaps if I'm really bold, or perhaps if it's appropriate in their developmental stage, I might say, at the end of the meeting, I want to walk out the door with my arm around my son. Have him know that I'm in his corner and that I support him and that there is healing. Maybe that's too much. Maybe my picture of success is simply that I know better what's going on because I say to myself, this is a great kid. This is a great son. So why has he done this? Why has he been in this car? Why have the police come upon him? Perhaps he's not doing as well in school as I thought. Perhaps he's having trouble with a girlfriend. Perhaps that peer group that I thought was supporting him is not really a great peer group. And so I have a clear picture going into this meeting that at the end of the meeting, I will have a much better idea what's going on with my child. So do you see what I'm saying? That vision, the picture of success, can be a long-term thing that you say, in the end, I want a mature, caring, loving, responsible adult. But it can also be a very short-term tool to help you ask, what is success right now with this child, right in this week? Does it mean things will be easy? That meeting will go smoothly? That there will be no raised voices or even slamming doors? Of course not. But it will give you a mooring point, a clear sense, this is the success I want. This is the outcome I want. And that is what great leaders are about, is getting very clear about outcomes and holding on to them, even in the darkest and most difficult moments. You might look in the workbook at page 3 and put some examples of tough parenting situations. Describe the situation very briefly, and then on the right side, put down, what is my picture of success? What do I really want to accomplish here and now? The most important thing, again, the most important thing to be a great parent leader has nothing to do with what your kids are doing. And it doesn't even have anything to do with what you're saying. It has everything to do with what you're doing. So take a look at that list of the things that you would like your children to become, of the ways that you would like them to be in the world. Maybe you saw them as loving, then be loving. Maybe you saw them as honest. Then think very deeply yourself and very honestly about how honest you are, especially with them. If you make a mistake, do you tell them the truth? Many of us fear doing that, but you know what? Our kids will still see us big, and they'll still see us as adults, even if we admit when we do something wrong. And as they're older, I would say, especially when we admit that we've done something wrong. If you see your kids as giving, be giving. If your picture of success for your kids is that they're risk takers and take on the world, then by all means, ask yourself, geez, am I taking risks? Am I doing things differently? Am I standing back from something? No matter what it is that you want your children to become, ask yourself in a ruthless way, am I doing what I'm asking them to do? James Baldwin, the great novelist, said it so well. Children have never been very good at listening to their elders, but they have never failed to imitate them. The best thing you can do if you have a picture of success for your kids is to be yourself every day that picture of success. Page 4 in the workbook gives you a very simple exercise to do this kind of, well, you could call it an audit. It simply asks you to write the core values from the earlier exercise, and next to each of the values, ask a couple simple questions that will help you to see how you can better align your behavior to your values. Okay, so let's shift now to talk about ways to really build up your children, and in a coming section, about how to correct them, coach them, and counsel them. But first, let's talk about how to build them up. I'll tell you a story that was embarrassing to me at the time, but tremendously helpful. My oldest daughter was in seventh grade, and she was playing on a basketball team in our city's recreational league. I went to most of her games and enjoyed watching her play and was really wrapped up in it and excited about how she was playing. I had coached her myself and counseled her and spent lots of time in the driveway having fun with her and improving her skills, and I loved to see her play. Well, on this particular team, she was coached not by me, but by a fellow who also taught at the high school. He was a really fine teacher, and I liked him. I didn't know him that well. Well, he came up to me before a playoff game was about to start, and he said, "Hey, Dan, will you do me a favor?" Well, how could I say no? Of course I would do him a favor. And I said, "Sure, coach, what do you want me to do?" And he said, during the game, he said, "I want to ask you to just not say anything critical about Kate." He said, "Let me do that." He said, "You be the one building her up, and I'll be the one that can then give her some guidance and some constructive criticism. Do you think you can do that?" Well, I felt like it was a little bit of a sucker punch. He asked me to do him a favor. Wasn't that the pretense? But now he was suggesting that I change my behavior, and in fact, he was talking about a pretty private thing about how I related to my kids, and he was really implying, it seemed like, that I was doing some things wrong. All of that was rifling through my head, and I was thinking, well, I've heard him critical of his kid, too. But I said, "Sure, Scott, I'd be happy to try to do that." And that began an amazing lesson for me. During that game, I found that repeatedly I was about to say to Kate, "Go to your left, get back on defense, keep your head up," and 100 other things that a little point guard should have going on in their head. And I had to do what? Bite my tongue. I couldn't say anything. I'd promised not to be negative. And the other thing I realized, wow, there was a terrible ratio, because so frequently, I found myself ready to say critical things to Kate, to tell her to go in a different direction, use her left hand, look up the court. And so infrequently did I find myself ready to catch her doing something good and shout some praise for her hustle, for her looking up, for her shooting the ball, for her playing defense. It was quite an experience. Well, that story is a story that needs to be flipped on its head. My experience needs to be flipped on its head. Your experience, perhaps, needs to be flipped on its head. By that I mean, for every 7, 8, 9 times you want to say something critical for your child, there should be 70, 80, 90 times when you say something specific and positive and warm. Encouragement is the most positive an important thing that you can do in communications with your children. Build a base where they know that you see them doing good things. Let them know that you appreciate what they do. Let them see and hear through their own eyes what you see that they're great at, so that they can swell not only in their own sense of goodness, but in their ability to trust you, to know that you find them good and valuable. It is perhaps the most powerful human need to be seen as worthwhile, to be seen as a contributor. And people who think they are contributors will change everything. They will be more generous. They will be more receptive, as we'll talk about later. So here's the key. Think about what the management literature says about encouragement. The Gallup Foundation has a wonderful guide and a set of questions that they call the Q12. And these Q12, these 12 questions, frame what is a great manager. And the fourth of those questions is totally pertinent here. A person is asked, in the last 7 days, have you received recognition or praise for doing good work? In other words, great managers catch their people doing good work at least once a week and recognize or praise them. The standard should probably be higher in the family. Do each of your children get praise or recognition at least one time a week? And you might think about the standards and criteria for great feedback. It should be timely. In other words, catch them right in the act, when it's real and genuine for them, when they know you're not making it up, but they know exactly what you're talking about. So you say, "Oh, Joe, that was so nice of you to do that for your brother. I am so impressed." Or when you say, the minute Catherine hands you that report card, "Catherine, what a great job you've done." Or whatever other behavior you're trying to enforce. Make it timely, make it specific. So again, it's not general, something they can discard as mom or dad trying to be nice to them, but that it's very specific and oriented towards some particular behavior, hopefully something they've tried to do, something they've been intentional about, something they've been thoughtful about. And make it understandable, of course, to them. What are you telling them they did well? The more specific it is, the more valuable it is. So you could look on page 5 and use it as just a simple guide. Write down the names of your children and think about the last week. Think about some things they've done. Or even think forward. What do you expect them to do? Where can you catch them doing good things? Where do they have great strengths that you want to let them know you see them and that you value them and you want to see them do them more and you want to see them enjoy that? Think about what it was like for me at that game. Perhaps what it's like for you sometimes, that you push so hard, you want your kids to be so great, that you miss the moments to savor. What a wonderful experience for me to have to watch the positive and realize, wow, look at her do that. Look at her do that. Look at the smile on her face. Look at how she's enjoying the game. Look at her intensity. It changed completely the way I saw my child and helped me to value her so much more greatly. In the end, it also made me a much better coach for her because I was going to be positive and I was going to lay a great foundation to be able to coach her from time to time to be better. Let's talk about time for a minute. Our middle child, our younger daughter, was once described by a neighbor as being like chocolate. Just a wonderful child, even from when she was very tiny, very relational and warm and affectionate. Just had a way of connecting with people and making them feel good in a certain way. But there came a time, actually quite early in her life, when she was about 2, that I sensed a distance. I didn't know what was going on or whether she was going through a developmental stage early that young, because she wasn't jumping in my lap, wasn't hugging me the same way. There was some gap in there. And at about this time, I was talking to a friend of mine who happened to be a psychologist. I knew him for other reasons, but I related this story that I've just shared with you, this sense of distance or detachment from my child. And this man said to me, "Well, are you spending much time with her?" I had to laugh. I thought, What a crazy question. It takes a child psychiatrist to ask me if I'm spending time with my child. This is like the sophisticated and complicated and intricate sort of explanation for what's going on. Are you spending enough time with your child? Of course, the answer was, no, I wasn't. In fact, I was working on a political campaign. I was managing a campaign for someone running for Congress, and I was working 5, 6, 7 days a week most of the time, and many times 10, 11, 12, even more hours than that. Was I spending time with her? No, I wasn't spending time with her. Well, that was one of those duh moments that you have every once in a while. But what a wonderful moment, because what was the prescription? Spend time with her. Spend quality time. That's quality, but it's also time. There's a quantitative element. There is no escaping that. Relationships are built upon time, upon a wasting of time, when there's hanging out, when there's not a lot of pressure, and mostly, most important of all, when there's not a lot of distraction, when the child is the focus, when the relationship is the focus. When you're hanging out at the zoo or talking in the car or sitting on the bedside, it's spending time with them. Fast forward, you get a child who's a teenager and they're having difficulty and things aren't going well. And you start to worry about the peer group or worry about what they're doing on a Friday night or worry about their relationship with a boy or a girl, depending who they are. And what's the first thing you should ask yourself? Am I spending time with them? People are innately, inherently social. They must and will spend time with other people. And if you are concerned because they are 8 or 10 or 16 or 18, and you don't feel like there is closeness in your relationship, you feel like the trust is waning, you feel like there's a distance, you feel like there's an awkwardness, step number one. Step up the amount of time you're spending with them. It is that simple, it is that powerful, and it is that pervasive. In most of the tracks that I've shared with you so far, I've been talking about children no matter what their age. Of course, little kids, little problems, big kids, big problems, but the fundamental aspects of having a vision and a picture of success, of having values, of encouraging, and of spending time are true whether the child is 6 months old, 6 years old, or 16. But in this case, I want to talk about energy. And energy is an issue that particularly begins around the middle school time, maybe as early as fifth grade or so, when a real change takes place. In fact, of course, lots of changes are taking place. But here's the fundamental one that has occurred to me in watching my children reading and reflecting about others. At a certain age, children start to take on the world. Up to that age, life is generally fun. Even school tends to be fun. There isn't a lot of pressure, and home is a normal place, and they tend to enjoy it there and roll with the punches. They're not too conscious about what's going on, and not too nervous for the most part. That is, if they're blessed to be in a family where there is no abuse or neglect, but that they're generally cared for. They're happy moments and simple moments, and kids oftentimes spring out of bed at night. They fight going to bed at the end of the night. They don't mind going to school unless they're having really difficult problems with other children or with coping at school. But they're welcoming life, and they seem to be full of resilience, and then it starts to change. Around fifth or sixth grade, they don't want to get up in the morning. The school is not as exciting. They complain more. Their social relations get more complicated. Sports start to get less fun and more difficult and challenging and competitive for many of them. Life starts to get serious. And it occurred to me, as I watched my kids become teenagers and now start to think about dating and college and peer groups and what kind of behavior and separating from home, I realized a huge change had happened. And here's how I would describe it. They became like us. They became like my wife and me. In the morning, what do Jennifer and I do? Well, we kind of strap on our armor. We think about the challenges in front of us, the problems we have to solve, how we're going to balance work and life, get the kids to school, what challenges we have at work, what she has to do as governor or I have to do in my world. And we think about problems in front of us and opportunities, and we're really churning. And we strap on our armor. And guess what? If you have a child who's 12, 13, 14, 15, you know what they're doing in the morning? They're strapping on their armor. They're thinking, I'm not really ready for earth science or for algebra. They're thinking, I hope that boy doesn't do what he did to me yesterday. They're wondering, is practice going to be brutal again today? They're thinking, am I going to get into college? They're wondering, is my girlfriend really interested in my boyfriend? All kinds of things are on their minds. They haven't had enough sleep almost inevitably. So what's happening with them in the morning? They're strapping on their armor. It's not personal about you. They're not distant from you. And what is the last thing they want from you? To tell them to clean their room, to worry about the money, to talk to them again about sex and drugs and rock and roll. They're already putting on the burdens of the world. So what is the point that at this time in the morning and at so many other times, our fundamental job of leaders is to help them get energized, that the world is going to challenge them, it's going to take them on, and they're going to feel some conflict and some challenge and some difficulty in many different places, socially, physically, athletically, in terms of their self-image. So my advice to you, start the morning great. Ask yourself, when those kids go out the door, do they know that I'm behind them, that I'm backing them, that I love them, that no matter what happens in the day, they can come home to this house? How do you generate that kind of energy? First, with a major, major shift in attitude. Know that your kids are strapping on their armor. See if you can contribute in little ways. In the next section, I'll talk more generally about energy. But know from the beginning that they need your support, they need your strength, and they need your energy as they strap on their armor to take on the world. In the end, it's all about empowerment. But gosh, it's hard to get there. Empowerment. Let's look at the leadership literature for a minute, because perhaps this is one of the most powerful places where listening to what the leadership scholars tell us about business and political leadership will help us to see so much about what's important in parental leadership. Well, my friend Jim Kouzes, who writes a wonderful book called The Leadership Challenge, says this: credible leaders accept and act upon the paradox of power. We become most powerful when we give our own power away. Wow, what a cool thought. So if you're a manager, you become the most powerful manager, not when you hold on to decision-making and to power, but when you empower other people. So if you have five people reporting to you and they become incredibly capable, think how much more you get done than if you are just the super leader. Or here's how my friend Ron Heifetz, who works at the Kennedy School of Government and started leadership programs there, describes leadership. He says it's about getting people to do the things that only they can do. In other words, the leader's job, he says at one point, is to fail their people, or to pace the rate of their failure. Because he says the point is not for leaders to get it done. Leaders can't change a company, change a city, change a country. It takes tens and hundreds, thousands of people doing things different. So the point of leadership is not to try to do things again, solve all the problems yourself, but to focus and empower your people to solve their problems. Okay, now look, if that's true, in the business world, in the political world, that leadership is about empowering others, getting them to be able to face their problems, isn't that so much more true of parenting? Isn't the fundamental job of a parent to make yourself obsolete, to make it so that they don't need you, so that they are perfectly capable and empowered and enabled to take on the world. And then, here is the cruel hoax. God gives us infants and toddlers. And so we begin by having to do everything for them, putting food in their mouth, removing waste from their rear ends, taking care of feeding them and clothing them and keeping them warm, keeping them away from fire and sharp objects. Everything we do is to be all-powerful. And then a shift begins almost immediately, and it continues. And of course, it ratchets up as they start to fight us and push away. And so we have all of these instincts to control and manage and dictate and drive them and push them and feed them and clothe them and take care of them and discipline them. But our job is always, fundamentally, to work toward empowering them. And this is something we can never forget. So what does it mean? Well, the core purpose is to remember that your job is to create an adult who can make decisions, who can take care of things, who can think their way through problems. And so from the very beginning, the more choice we can give children, with consequences that we can help them to understand, and with support as they make decisions, the more effective we will be. We can start this when they are very young, to clarify choices, to help them talk out how is it that they want to think about whether they want to play now or work now, how they're going to get their jobs done, how they're going to treat other people, and understanding the consequences of that. Well, Tommy, if you don't play with Mary very well, she's not going to want to share her toys with you. So you can decide, but know that if you don't share with her, she's not going to share with you. And of course, the questions become bigger and more complex. But increasingly, as they become older and as they become teenagers, our job is to shift from being on top of them, above them, to increasingly turning to be next to them, to face the world shoulder to shoulder with them, to see, what is it that you're seeing, my son, my beloved daughter? What are the choices in front of you? What happens if you quit that sport? What happens if you quit piano? What might follow from that? What will you do with that additional time you have? What's important to you? What would you like to accomplish? As you turn and shift from the one making decisions and controlling to the one observing with them and supporting as they see what's in front of them and supporting them as they make decisions, then you become that credible leader whom they will listen to, because you are acting on the paradox of power. We all become most powerful when we give our power away, when we help them to make the decisions that will guide their lives. Then, increasingly, they will turn to us as people who can help them think through these issues, and they will become the kinds of leaders who will in turn raise children, able themselves to make great decisions. My oldest daughter, Kate, was about 14 years old when we had one of our awful blowout arguments. I can't for the life of me remember what it was about. Something rather trivial in retrospect, that's for sure. Maybe it was about a sleepover or whether I was being fair to each of my children, but we'd had a real humdinger. Kate, you have to understand, is strong-willed and bright and loves to argue, and as they say, sometimes the nut does not fall very far from the tree. Well, we had this little argument. A few minutes later, I walked into her room. She said to me, "Are you open to some coaching?" Well, that was kind of a hard question for her to ask. There was a part of me that sort of thought, who does this young lady think she is, asking me if I need coaching? Isn't this a little bit backwards here? But humored by it and somewhat intrigued and very curious about this, I said, "Yeah, I'm open to some coaching. What is it?" And she said, Next time, when you get mad, maybe you could think about counting to 10. Well, I said, okay, I will. I still felt a little bit of that residue of irritation that this child was giving me counsel, but on the other hand, I thought, it's not bad counsel. Makes some sense. Well, let me come back to that story about a kid coaching their parent. But first, let me suggest this. All of us want to influence our kids. All of us have a sense that we've been around the block, that we have some wisdom, that there's some things that we can tell our children to help them and to spare them from pain, to support them as they move in what we think is a positive direction, perhaps not to make the mistakes that we made. And so we want to guide them. Now, we know we want to empower them, but still we want to tell them what to do sometimes. Well, how can we do that? Here is the most practical suggestion I think I can possibly give you, and that is, do what my daughter Kate did. Say to your child, whether that child is 7 or 17, hey, Kate, are you open to some coaching? Or you might use words that are more comfortable to you. You might say, are you open to an idea here? Or can I share with you a thought that I have? Now, let me stop there. It is absolutely vital that you really mean to give them a choice, that you're not telling them, but asking them, would they like to hear something? And then, having done that, as openly and honestly as you can, listen to the answer. And if they say yes, say, okay, here's what I've noticed, and go on with the coaching or the advice or the observation. And if they say no, then say, okay, and walk away. Now, chances are, if you say to a 14-year-old kid, are you open to some advice, or can I share a thought with you about that? In a tone of voice where you really are freely offering it, and you're not compelling them to take it, you're not going to guilt them or overpower them into taking advice, but you genuinely want to give them the option, and they say no, and you say okay, what do you think most adolescent or 8 or 10-year-old kids will do? I'll tell you what they'll do. They'll say, wait, Dad, come back. I do want to hear. Tell me what you have to say. And then you can confirm, are you sure? Because I don't have to give you this counsel, this coaching, this advice. And they say, no, I want to hear it. Then again, you share it. And there's a third possibility. You say, son, are you open to a different way of seeing things? Are you open to some input from your old man? And your son says, yeah, sure, Dad, but his tone of voice says to you, no, I'm not the least bit interested. You know, the word is, yes, Dad, tell me, but the music beneath the lyrics are, I don't want to hear a darn thing you have to say, no. Well, then if you hear that tone of voice, you may want to just clarify and say, well, you said yes, but I'm not sure by your tone of voice that you really want to hear. Again, this is said in a non-judgmental way. You're simply observing it. And they may say, well, yeah, I don't really want to hear. And again, then you can walk away. Now, worst case scenario is that you don't get to give your advice. Even in that worst case scenario, though, you've built up credibility with your child because you've respected them. You've offered an opinion, they've said they don't want to hear it, and you've respected that and walked away. Isn't that the kind of behavior that you would want shown to you? And then if you just give them the advice that they give you the permission to give, then you can walk away and they have a chance to decide. What a powerful, powerful tool. Ask the child, are you open to some coaching? Can I share some thoughts? Could I offer some advice to you? And then maybe you'll be as lucky as I was at one point to have your child say to you, Mom, Dad, are you open to some coaching? What a respectful thing for your child to ask. What a loving thing that they would care to help to make you a better parent. At that point, you know you're turning a corner. Something marvelous is happening. So consider approaching them with respect.